Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Annalee Newitz, author of her first novel, Autonomous, published tomorrow by Tor. Annalee's career started 15 years back in San Francisco at The Guardian. Later, she worked at Wired, and then she founded the super cool io9 at Gawker. She edited io9 for 7 years. Then she became the editor-in-chief at Gizmodo. Since last year, she's been an editor at Ars Technica, which is also super cool. She's also been published in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The Times, The Atlantic, and many other publications. She also writes about movies, TV, and books in the sci-fi fantasy genre, which ties in nicely with this, you know, her first venture into novel writing with Autonomous. Autonomous is about free will, love, corporate greed, and deceit and loyalty. It follows the path of Jack Judith Chen, a modern-day pirate who reverse-engineers drugs and supplies them to the market in spite of the inherent but ill-gotten rights of major drug companies with semi-familiar names. Hot on Jack's trails are two corporate cops, one human and one robotic, Elias and Paladin, who have their own unusual and unique relationship with each other. Jack seeks help along the way and finds it from some highly likely and highly unlikely sources. But the high concept that runs through the book and really resonated with me is this concept of autonomy and what it means. And we can talk about that a little bit today. So with that, welcome, Annalee, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why is it important to discuss and to title the book in such a way in the context of a sci-fi thriller? Why is it so important that autonomy is the structure within which you decided to work?
Well, a lot of the characters in the book, in fact, I would say all of the major characters, are struggling with the question of what it means to be free. And they're living in a future, it's about 150 years in the future, where indentured servants are part of the economy. So we've reinvented slavery under a slightly nicer name. In fact, the slave economy is referred to as the human resources economy. And so there, some of the characters, like Paladin, the robot, is an indentured servant. Another one of the characters is an escaped indentured servant. And they are all trying to figure out, what does it mean to be property or not be property? If you are property, can you make any decisions? And of course, Jack, the pirate character, she doesn't really know that much about indenture, but she's spent her whole life fighting intellectual property and fighting to bring patented drugs to the poor who can't have access to them because of intellectual property laws. And so she's looking at property in a whole different way and trying to understand freedom in the context of intellectual property. And so I wanted to talk about how autonomy and freedom and property can mean a lot of different things and can imprison us in a lot of different ways. And that two people who are struggling with the same problems might not actually realize it, because Jack doesn't really know anything about indenture, like I said, and Paladin doesn't really care about intellectual property very much, other than the fact that Paladin's been ordered to go out and chase down this IP pirate. So I think, you know, it's always important to be thinking about what it means to make free choice. But what's really fun in a novel is to have several people trying to make those choices under really weird, different conditions and kind of setting them up against each other and getting readers hopefully to think about all the ways that they might be constrained in their everyday lives that they haven't thought about before.
Yeah, I know. And it's funny because your dedication, which is for all the robots who question their programming, got me thinking too, because are you talking about me? am I one of those?
Yeah.
I am
talking about you. I mean, and I don't mean that in a bad way, because some of your programs are probably super awesome. you know, you probably play games and, you know, enjoy culture and all that stuff comes from programming. But one of the big themes that I wanted to hit in this book was we think of robots and computers as being things that are programmed and therefore they're, you know, objects and they don't have any free will. But humans are also programmed. You know, we're born like as boring little blobs and we become the awesome, complicated creatures that we are through learning about culture from our families and schools and people around us and television and the internet. And that is programming. And there's a lot of contemporary psychology that looks at things like stereotype priming, which is just a basic way that people get programmed. And there have been some really interesting studies showing that, you know, if you get a group of kids in a room and you give them a math test and you tell them before the test, girls are bad at math and boys are good at math, the girls will do worse on the test. And then if you flip things around and you say, girls are great at math, the girls will score higher. And that's just a great example of, you know, a simple way that people get kind of programmed to succeed or fail on a test. And of course, there's much bigger ways that we get programmed too. We get programmed with all kinds of biases and pleasures and things that we don't really have under our control, like why we fall in love with certain kinds of people or why we like certain kinds of food. But that does all come out of early programming.
It's funny because you've given a little bit of an idea about the novel and we can talk more about the structure of it. But Paladin, the robot, he seems like he's, from the very beginning, questioning, as you suggest, his programming and wondering, especially with regard to his partner, why his partner has certain feelings and emotions and motivations. And I wondered, what was it that got Paladin starting to question his very programming? And then you have, and at first I thought it was a red herring, and then I thought, well, maybe it's not, the fact that behind Paladin's carapace is a human brain, and that the human brain maybe put there for a silly reason or for no reason or maybe for an important reason. And I thought that was fascinating. And I don't know how you came up with it.
I love brains. I definitely wanted, I mean, I do, you know, it's a little spoilery to talk too much about what the brain turns out to be. But one of the themes in the book is that, you know, there's some robots that are all technological. They're made, you know, they're made out of various kinds of carbon alloy and other substances, but they're not biological. They're not made of biological tissue. Or if they are, it's kind of, it's like a mix of biological tissue and other stuff. But then some robots are made with actual human tissue on them. So either they're kind of like skin jobs, like from Battlestar Galactica, where they just look like people, but they have an endoskeleton that's made of carbon, or they have just certain body parts. And so Paladin looks like a giant mech. I mean, he's really this big, burly fighting machine, but he does have a human brain that's used mostly for facial recognition, recognizing facial expressions. So he's kind of using it as like a visual processor. He's not able to access memories. It's not like a RoboCop thing where he's like, one day he'll figure out, you know, what's in the brain. So we know that right away, but then the question is, how important is the brain? But to Elias, Paladin's human partner, the brain means everything because he sees the brain as being Paladin's true identity. And again, it's kind of like RoboCop, where, you know, we all assume that RoboCop's real self is in this human brain that lives inside of this robot body. And that's kind of what Elias thinks. But unlike RoboCop, it isn't really the case. I mean, Paladin isn't really using the brain for thinking or feeling. That's all being done, you know, on basically, you know, the future equivalent of like a motherboard with a bunch of processors on it. And so I kind of wanted to talk about how people wind up kind of fetishizing certain organs and assuming that like having a certain organ says things about you. But at the same time, I wanted, you know, Paladin is questioning his programming, questioning why people are doing what they're doing, because Paladin has really only been born a few months before the action starts in the book. He's just been booted and has just completed his early training, and he's going on his first mission. So it's kind of a coming of age story. He's trying to figure out, you know, who he is and what his place is in the world. And that's made really hard by the fact that he's indentured. Part of his brain is locked down. He doesn't have root access on his own brain, so he can't change his programs. He can't even see what programs he's running. So he's just like a human. We can't actually see what programs we're running. We just run them. But I did want to suggest that that wasn't abnormal, because Paladin meets a lot of other robots in this story. We meet many different kinds of robots, some of whom are free and some who aren't, and they've all questioned their programming. They've all wondered whether they'll survive their indenture, but because, you know, some of them are indentured, there's certain thoughts that they're not really permitted to have and certain ideas that they can't really follow through on because they've been programmed not to. So all the robots have a kind of, I would guess, like, in a way, a kind of ironic distance on being enslaved. But at the same time, they are enslaved. so their questioning is kind of curtailed.
Yeah, and what you do with the reader with Paladin is ingenious, because, you know, you find you have this caring feeling towards Paladin, as if he's a human being, as if he's a friend. He has these kind, it's actually hard to describe the way you describe him. He's almost kind, but he's also capable of the most cruel violence too. And he doesn't question, because he doesn't have the capability of questioning that programming that allows him to commit those acts. But you turn him into like a bifurcated entity. Half the time you feel like, wow, you know, he's really come a long way, or he's really moving in the right direction. And then something happens where you go, wow, I can't believe that he just did that.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a killing machine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's what's fun about writing those kinds of characters. There's a great novel from the 90s by Margie Piercy called He, She, and It. And she deals a lot with that, too, because she has a character who is a killer cyborg, and he's designed to kill, and he's also a person. He has, you know, he's a human equivalent person who just has this programming. And that in that novel, the cyborg falls in love. And so we see, he has the same kind of problem. I mean, it's a very different kind of story from mine, but definitely it's that same bifurcation of, he's capable of love, he's capable of human connection, but when his programming kicks in, he has to just like murder everybody. And it's, in Margie Piercy's novel, it's unendurable. Like the cyborg can't live with himself. And I think Paladin doesn't have that problem at all. Paladin is like, whatever I have to do to survive, I'm going to do to survive and, you know, just get through it.
Yeah, but at the same time, he's got this caring type feeling towards Elias that he wants to nurture the relationship that they have.
Yeah, I mean, I think Paladin is coming of age. He's learning about connection, emotional connection, sexual connection. In some ways, I kind of think of Paladin as being like equivalent to a human who's like maybe 19 or 20 and, you know, just really kind of figuring out their sexuality, beyond just kind of fumbling around. And, Paladin really is attracted to Elias, and Elias is the first human who's ever treated Paladin like something other than a tool. And so, I think, yeah, Paladin has the capacity to be a gentle, sweet, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, you know, whatever Paladin wants to be in the end. I think that Paladin never in the novel, I mean, maybe someday in Paladin's future beyond the novel, Paladin never really thinks about that contradiction, because for most of the novel, Paladin is completely programmed and doesn't have much control over what he feels.
So you just paid homage to a novel. What did you think about getting blurbed by Neal Stephenson and William Gibson and compared by both to, you know, Neuromancer?
That was surprising. I mean, I am a huge fan of both of their work. I was blown away. I kept wondering if they'd actually read the right novel. I've tried to take from writing like Neal Stephenson and William Gibson's is, I mean, in the case of Stephenson, like, I love how he does violence in his books. Like, I think he's really great at having these like long cerebral violent scenes, and not in all of his novels, but he often does have these moments where we get a lot of character development through violence and through combat scenes. Right. And I love action movies and I love combat stuff. And so I've just always really admired that about him. And so I've tried to do that in my novel. And the thing that I love about William Gibson, and the thing that, like, when I first read Neuromancer when I was pretty young, just like blew me away was, he's so great at ambiguity. Like, we get these characters that we kind of love and identify with, but there's always something broken about them or kind of wrong with them, but they're also great. And we also root for them. And he never lets us off the hook. Like, he's never like, well, now everything's okay. Or now the world is heading in a better direction. He's always like, well, some things are fixed. Some things are more broken now. I love that. And that's definitely what I've done in Autonomous. And I've actually had people say to me that they didn't like that. You know, they were like, what? You kind of left us feeling like things weren't all right. And I was like, well, that's how life is.
I know.
Like, nothing is all right.
Isn't it funny how some readers want you to, like, tie everything up and wrap it up by the end so that they know exactly what happened and what's going to happen in the future, and some readers want exactly the opposite?
Yeah, I mean, I have sympathy for both sides. I mean, I love both kinds of things in stories. And if you're reading a story for comfort and escape, which is a perfectly legitimate reason to read, it's hard to have a book that's like, now you have to look at ugly things and consider the possibility that nothing is true or whatever. And you're like, I just want a romance where, like, at the end they're happy. I think you just have to make sure that you have some of both.
The other thing about Stephenson and Gibson when you read them is you get this feeling, you know, you drift into this concept that maybe you're actually living in the present. When they write, you actually feel like, wait a minute, this is really happening. This is what the real world is like now. And that happened lots in this book, too. And so we haven't talked about Jack at all, but let's talk about Zacuity, the drug. You model your characters after things that happen in your life and people you know and things like that. What drug did you model Zacuity after? Adderall on steroids? Forgive the expression.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of any specific drug. Adderall, definitely. Provigil, I was thinking of. One time I was at a conference that was very long and grueling that I was covering, and a friend of mine was like, hey, you should try some Provigil, it'll really help. I use it all the time for staying sharp while I'm writing. And I was like, well, okay, why not? And he gave me just this tiny, like, a quarter of a dose, and it just it was not good. I just remember the feeling that it gave me, where I was like, I felt like all my hair was walking off my head, and I was like trembling, and like I was very focused, but it didn't feel like a good focus. It felt like a crazy nerve jangly focus, and so definitely that made an impression on me. But also I was thinking more generally of the fact that the pharmaceutical industry now provides us with therapeutic drugs for actual ailments. But they also are providing us more and more with enhancer drugs, or like fun time drugs, basically, that are for things like just like sharpening your attention or keeping you awake or helping you have an erection, which, again, all those things are fine. Like, I'm not anti staying awake and I'm definitely pro erection. But But at the same time, those are not, those are drugs that are really aimed at kind of at making our lives better, not necessarily curing us or helping us with a with some kind of disease or affliction. And so that blurring of the line in pharmaceuticals between, let's call them like entertainment drugs versus therapeutic drugs, I think is really dangerous. Again, I'm not against selling drugs that are for enhancement. I just think that maybe they should be regulated differently. Certainly the business model for those drugs should not be the same as the business model for like AIDS drugs and cancer drugs. But we see more and more in the case of like Martin Shkreli is a great example, where pharmaceutical executives are just like, well, you know, if people want these drugs, like, let's just charge as much as we possibly can. And, you know, we'll price them like luxury cars or something like that. And so health becomes this kind of luxury. And companies have all kinds of nefarious ways of keeping drugs under patent so that they will have cornered the market on that drug. And so it really, that whole system I find to be incredibly broken. And so I really wanted a character who is fighting it in the future when it gets really bad.
Well, she is a pirate. And actually, if you read the lengthy epigraph, which is which is The Last Saskatchewan Pirate from The Arrogant Worms, that, I mean, he's not a good guy, the pirate. I mean, he's kind of a good guy. He's taking care of himself and his family, but he's also stealing. And then you have the blurred line that you were talking about with the drug companies. How do you feel about someone taking charge and reverse engineering what are owned, patented drugs?
I mean, I've always been very much in favor of piracy in the face of corporate greed. And I think that, you know, sometimes you need direct action to challenge oppression. And there's all different kinds of oppression. And this is one kind. And in the case of Jack, unlike the pirate in the Arrogant Worm song, you know, she's not stealing things that are really owned. She's taking drugs and reverse engineering them, and she's making her own version, but it's not like she's going into someone's house and stealing their baby or stealing their personal chair. These are pieces of intellectual property, and this is an incredibly wealthy company that has drugs, and this is in the future, but they have drugs for treating autism, they have drugs for cancers, they have drugs for ailments that we don't even know about yet because it's 150 years in the future. But they're able to do a lot. The kinds of drugs that Jack specializes in are all ones that have to do with errors in DNA replication mostly. So it's a lot of cancer stuff. And the fact that companies are not making those drugs available to people simply because they don't have money just seems profoundly unfair. And it seems to go against the whole idea of medicine and what doctors are supposed to do and what, you know, what medical professionals are supposed to do. So that kind of gets back to what I was saying about kind of drawing a brighter line between entertainment drugs versus therapeutic drugs,
right?
Because Jack's big mistake, and she does make a big mistake and she really screws up,
big
is
time.
She starts reverse engineering some of these fun time drugs like Zacuity, which is just an attention enhancer. And, you know, kind of gets away from her main mission, which is really bringing medicine to the poor. And so once she does that, yeah, bad things happen because that really isn't kind of her mission. You know, her mission is really to help people, and giving them just drugs that'll enhance their attention is not really saving any lives.
And
in fact, it's actually killing people.
Yeah, I was going to say, because of what Zacuity does, she owns a lot of responsibility, not only to the people that take what she produces, but also to the people that help her along the way. And you create a lot of ambiguity there with regard to her character. At first I didn't think you did. I mean, at first I was thinking, okay, she's straight up, she's a pirate, she's cool. And then I realized, no, she really kind of, like you said, messed up big time.
Yeah, she gets, I mean, you know, and one of the things that's fun about her character is she's older. She looks like she's in her 30s because she's been taking, you know, various drugs to kind of extend her healthy part of her life. But she's like in her 50s. So she's been around the block. She's seen things. She's been through some pretty horrific traumas. And, you know, she's kind of lost her way a little bit. And, you know, she's ultimately trying to do the right thing, but she starts manufacturing these entertainment drugs basically just to make a little extra money, partly to fund her really good work. And so, you know, this is what always happens, I think, with, you know, radical direct action, is that on one hand, it does social good. On the other hand, it can go too far. It can easily shade into really ethical, really gray areas ethically. And so I really wanted to talk about that, about what it means to be a political radical, and trying to change the system without kind of replicating the worst parts of that system. And it's super hard to do. And so that's why Jack gets into trouble, because it's just a genuinely difficult thing.
You know, you said it over 100 years in the future, but after your time at IO9 and Gizmodo and Ars Technica and having your finger on the pulse of all the books that you read and review, don't you think that in some ways we're a lot closer to what you portray than we actually, you know, than we actually seems to be in the book? That, I mean, it seems to me that
it's actually going to happen next year instead of in 150 years.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That's the cool feeling you get when you're reading your book, that, you know, this could be now.
I think it could be now. I definitely think that the sort of radical anti-patent pharmaceutical pirate idea, you know, could happen much sooner than 150 years from now. It could happen in 10 years, maybe, in some form. And we already have people doing piracy for great justice. And in Europe, there's the Pirate Party, which, you know, stands for kind of the liberation of property from big content, and as well as a lot of other things. Other parts of the book, like, for example, having human equivalent AI, like having robots that are just basically people, but with like a different,
right,
you know, kind of body. Like, I felt like I was stretching it by having it be, having that exist in 150 years. I don't know that we're going to have human equivalent AI that soon, especially because in the book, we've had human equivalent AI for at least a couple of generations, because, you know, there's been like a whole history behind why people can own these robots, and what indentured servitude means for robots, and all of that's been worked out over decades. So my internal timeline was that they wind up getting kind of human equivalent intelligence in robots, like, I don't know, 30 or 40 years from now, which I totally don't think is going to happen. But I was just like, well, I want to have a robot character in a pretty well articulated robot culture. So, you know,
it's those things you don't think that'll happen and that are the things that happen, you know.
It's true. And, you know, I'd love to be friends with Paladin. Like, I hope there is like in my lifetime, a human equivalent Paladin type creature. So yeah, that'd be great. Especially if it had civil rights instead of being enslaved. So yeah, we should probably get on that, the civil rights thing.
Well, with that, thank you so much for joining us. That was an excellent explanation of all the questions I had about the book, and
great,
and the title and the epigraph and the dedication.
Awesome.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Anna Lee Newitz talking to us about her book, Autonomous, a book about a dystopian, semi-dystopian future in which there are robots and there are indentured servants that are robots and humans, and there's companies that are marketing all types of unusual enhancing drugs that are then pirated by this main protagonist, Jack, who's really Judith Chen. And it's an excellent book. It's a first-time book, but this woman has definitely been through, most of what's happened in tech over the past 15 years. from io9 to Gizmodo to Ars Technica to Wired, and like I said, to being blurbed by William Gibson and Neil Stephenson. So thanks very much to Annalee for joining us today. Coming up, we have Brendan Matthews, who's going to be sharing his highly anticipated debut novel, The World of Tomorrow, and one of my favorite authors of all time, Mark Helprin, who will discuss his latest novel, Paris in the Present Tense. So I would definitely hope that you would join us for that. And as always, thanks for being here with us on The Avid Reader.